Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 21st of August. Our guest this hour is the author of I Never Metaphor I Didn't Like, a comprehensive compilation of history's greatest analogies, metaphors, and similes. Dr. Marty Grothy is with us, and he is a psychologist, a management consultant, has received his PhD in psychology from Columbia University, and has written a number of other books, Oxymoronica, we'll ask him what that means, Vive la Liberté, and Never Let a Fool Kiss You or a Kiss Fool You. He speaks at annual conventions of trade and professional associations and lives in Raleigh, North Carolina, with his wife, Catherine. And, the book looks at how you can spice up your language. And he says if you come across certain metaphors or analogies or similes, you tend to see things in a whole different light. He has, as a result of having collected these for a number of years, he'll see a building in terms of what somebody has said about the building, and he sees humor in a different light simply because he pays very close attention to language. We're going to be welcoming phone calls, and I'm sure that you will be able to add, and that is, we hope, your mission this hour to his list of history's greatest analogies, metaphors, and similes. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that. That's talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hi, Marty. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Oh, our pleasure. So you have collected thousands of these. Tell me how that whole process started.
Well, I'm very fortunate. When I was in high school, I got bitten by the quotation bug. I had a high school guidance counselor and history teacher who loved to intersperse his lectures and conversation with quotations from great figures. And I just thought that was so cool. And eventually I began to collect them, and I've now written four books of quotation compilations, and this is just my latest.
Mm-hmm. And it causes you, actually, I was interested in some of the quotations that have caused you to see the world and to see things in the world in a whole new way.
Well, you know, that's absolutely true, and this is the essence of metaphorical thinking. When people try to describe one thing by relating it to something else, often something else quite different from the first thing, by making that mental connection between two different domains of life, it causes us to see the first thing in a totally new way. And I have a chapter in the book called Life-Altering Metaphors, mm-hmm. and I talk in there about how, really, when I had lost my way back in my college years, by just reading books from some really special authors, it was able to help me kind of find my path again. And Rudyard Kipling once said, metaphorically, of course, that words are the most powerful drug used by mankind, and I could not agree more.
Mm-hmm. And you actually kind of hold yourself away. You used to be, I think the president of the class and a hail fellow when well met, lots of friends, et cetera, and then all of a sudden you become a recluse, really.
Well, I'd gone to college with the notion of becoming a psychologist one day, and what happened was I kind of got seduced by the Joe College lifestyle of the time,
mm-hmm.
I guess it was kind of heady for me to, all of a sudden become elected the president of my fraternity, and I was the vice president of the student senate, and I liked all the stuff I was getting, but after a while, I realized it was fairly empty. And I was so overly involved in campus activities that, my grades began to suffer, mm. and, I was constantly feeling overwhelmed. And then one day I don't know what exactly happened, but, this house of cards I built, just came tumbling mm. down. And I just went off to live in a little off-campus apartment. I resigned from all of my organizations that I had been part of, and I tried to just find my way back,
mm-hmm.
And the one book, I mean, I talk about a bunch of books that really helped me back then, but, you know, the one book that probably more than any other book was Henry David Thoreau's Walden. Mm-hmm. And he has a wonderful metaphor. Your listeners know it because it's such a famous passage, but, you know, I was 20 years old and I just read it for the very first time. But in that book, he said, if a man does not keep pace with his companions, perhaps it is because he hears a different drummer.
Mm-hmm.
Let him step to the music which he hears, however measured or far away. And that was such a wonderful passage. It kind of described my life because I was beginning to hear, you know, the beat of a different drummer.
Right.
And it turned out that it was the very first step I was making to kind of finding my way back in the world again.
Mm-hmm. And at what point, you mentioned this in the book, at what point do we use some wonderful figure of speech? And we use it so much. I remember, I'm with you, I read Thoreau and I thought, oh my goodness, this is wonderful. I read it for the first time years ago. And now there's almost a triteness about it, that we pick certain things when there are so many others and we use them over and over and over. So
it doesn't
have its great beauty anymore.
Well, I mean, what you're talking about there, of course, is what happens when a clever little idea becomes so overly used or so immensely popular, it becomes a, you know, a hackneyed expression, or, of course, we have a word for them, we call them cliches. And I discovered this when I was working on the book, because I would often go up to people and I would say, well, tell me what you know about analogies, metaphors, and similes. And of course, a lot of people struggled with that. And what I learned was that many of them had sort of fallen asleep during their high school, you know, English lectures on the subject, so they weren't really that familiar with them. But going back to your point, when we got to the topic of similes, you know, many people said, oh, I know what a simile is. Happy as a clam, sharp as a tack, life is like a box of chocolates. And so the similes that they came up with, you know, were exactly the ones that you're talking about, these overly used kind of stale similes that didn't really stimulate anybody's thinking anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But what I've discovered is that, you know, if you take a metaphor like life is a journey, that's a common metaphor. We
right.
can turn that into a simile by just adding the words like or as. So
mm-hmm.
to say life is like a journey or would make that a simile. But on its own, that doesn't tell us very much. But look what happens when you take that metaphor and you tweak it a little bit. Isaac Asimov once said, life is a journey, but don't worry, you'll find a parking spot at the end. Or let me mention one more, and then I'll pause for a breath. Charles Schulz, one of my favorite guys, he wrote, you know, Charlie Brown, Peanuts, that comic strip.
Right.
He said, life is like a 10-speed bicycle. Most of us have gears we never use. Well, I mean, you know, he could have said, you know, most people don't live up to their potential.
Right, right.
But that would have been boring and dull and,
right.
and trite. But see, what he did is he did what all people do when they create a wonderful analogy or metaphor or simile. They create a visual image in our minds that we can relate to.
Mm-hmm. And that one goes up on the wall, right?
Oh, my goodness. That one went right up on the wall.
I'm sure it did. What do you think shows a higher level of, I don't know if the intellect is the word, or a higher level of being able to observe the world? What's hardest here? Is it analogy, metaphor, or simile?
Well, all of them require the same capacity. And by the way, it was a capacity that was recognized by Aristotle.
Hmm.
He said, you know, several thousand years ago now, that some people have what he called a keen eye for resemblance.
Mm-hmm.
And what he meant by that is some people, he called them masters of metaphor, have a gift for seeing a relationship between one thing and another thing. And these two things, these two domains of life, don't have anything to do with one another. But all of a sudden, when they make this connection between domain A and domain B, all of a sudden we see something in a totally new way. And, you know, this is part and parcel of intellectual history. When Shakespeare said, all the world's a stage, He was taking life on the planet, and he was relating it to life on the stage. And, of course, he talked about, you know, the parts people play and the exits and entrances that they make. But, in fact, you know, we could take that metaphor, the world is a stage. And just you and I, if we wanted to talk about it, we could spend an entire hour. And it's called pursuing the metaphor. You know, we could talk about great performances and mediocre and poor performances. And we could talk about people playing leading roles or people playing support roles. Or we could talk about the great preparation required to carry out a great role. So this whole notion of all the world's a stage is kind of fascinating. And other people pick up on it. Like Oscar Wilde said, the world is a stage, but the play is badly cast.
Who do you quote most often in I Never Met a Four I Didn't Like?
I'm sorry, could you say it again?
Who do you quote most often?
Oh, golly, you know, I have to look in the subject index for that one, but I would say all of the great wits and wordsmiths are here. So we've got, you know, Henry David Thoreau and Ralph Waldo Emerson and Mark Twain. You know, on Mark Twain's 70th birthday, he said, we can't reach old age by another man's road. And see, that's another example of a life is a journey metaphor, but it's expressed by him in a very, very special kind of way. You know, it's the kind of thing that maybe Shakespeare might have said when he said, to thine own self be true, but he expressed it in a new way. But all the great writers are represented here, and including many that people have never heard of before.
Right. And there's a lot of great humor in this, as well as sarcasm and all of that, right?
Well, you know, Peggy Noonan, the speechwriter for Ronald Reagan, said that humor is the shock absorber of life. You know, it helps us to take the blows. And it's a wonderful metaphor in its own right, but humor is just part and parcel of, you know, the human experience. And in fact, it is believed to have wonderful health benefits. Do you remember Norman Cousins?
Sure.
Well, Norman, may I mention this just for a moment?
Yeah.
Back in the 1970s, Norman Cousins was a very, very popular American figure. He was the editor of Saturday Review, and he was diagnosed with cancer. And it looked like a terminal cancer. And so as everybody's beginning to kind of prepare for his death, and he as well, he all of a sudden decided to take his own treatment into his own hands. And so what he did is he checked out of the hospital. He moved into a hotel across the street from the hospital, so he was nearby by his physicians, and every single day he would watch one episode of the Marx Brothers and one episode of Candid Camera, because he had a belief that laughter might be good for him, and especially hearty laughter that comes deep from the, you know, the soul.
Really?
And
mm-hmm.
And in fact, after about 6 months of this, his cancer went into remission, and he wrote an entire book on the subject. I can't remember the title right now, but in the book he said, laughter is internal jogging. And it was just a nice little metaphor to describe that, you know, just like physical exercise is good for the body, laughter is good for the body and the soul.
It sure is. And I love this. I'm going to be this way now, too. When you talk about Mason Cooley, the American writer who said a skyscraper is a boast in glass and steel, and now you rarely visit a major American city without thinking about that.
Well, I mean, isn't this interesting? It's exactly the point we were talking about earlier. I mean, nobody ever before in history had ever related skyscrapers to bragging and boasting. But, you know, if you travel around America, but now especially if you travel around the world, you know, what do you see? You see nations trying to outdo one another with the biggest and the boldest and the most dramatic skyscrapers. So that little notion that, as he said, a skyscraper is a boast in glass and steel is an absolutely, in my opinion, unforgettable metaphor. In fact, I believe that comes from my chapter on definitive metaphors, does it not?
Yes, it does.
Well, what I'm saying there is that You know, when we say something is definitive, you know, generally what we mean is that it's so good, it serves as the standard by which other things can be judged. If we say something is the definitive book on Elvis, you know, what we mean by that is it's like the number one book that you want to go to. And just like there are definitive books, I think there are definitive quotations. And I've got maybe, you know, 75 or 100 of them in that particular chapter. And, you know, some are serious and some are witty. But, you know, when John Mason Brown, the 1970s and 80s critic, said, "Television is chewing gum for the eyes," that, I think, belongs as a definitive metaphor because, you know, watching television is kind of a mindless activity for a lot of people. But to all of a sudden see it related to something like chewing gum is absolutely spectacular. And the thing that makes that observation so remarkable is John Mason Brown did not author it. He heard that comment from one of his 16-year-old son's best friends.
Oh.
And so, see, that's what's neat about this. I mean, you don't have to be a Shakespeare or a Ralph Waldo Emerson or an Oscar Wilde to create these unforgettable metaphors. You know, sometimes, you know, they can come to just average people.
Dr. Marty Grothy is our guest. His book is I Never Metaphor I Didn't Like, a comprehensive compilation of history's greatest analogies, metaphors, and similes. And we're welcoming phone calls, 1-800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. And if you want to send an email, that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network. We go to phone calls now and start them with Ralph from Milwaukee. Hi, Ralph.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. I wanted to ask the guest if he's ever heard of the Sufi poetry literary device called the coconut.
No, I have not. I'm a little bit familiar with Sufi poetry, but I'm not familiar with that concept.
Oh, yeah, so coconut is the story behind it. And the story goes a traveling dervish was wandering in the desert, and they began to get hungry, and they tired from the sun. So they sit underneath a tree, and a monkey threw a coconut from the tree, and it landed on the Sufi's head, and it broke open, and he drank the milk and ate the flesh, and used the shell as a bowl.
Aha!
And the coconut is a very, it's like a triple entendre, where you find, you use an analogy or a metaphor to unlock other knowledge about yourself inside and out.
How perfect. Mm. Thank you, Ralph. You know, and that reminds me, and I think your listeners probably are aware of this too, whenever we use words like allegories or parables, just like this example of the coconut in Sufi poetry, you know, it kind of looks like we're talking about one thing, but in fact, you know, we can really use that to talk about another thing, and that's the brilliance of so much of what goes by the name of metaphorical thinking.
Thanks so much for your call. Ruth is next from Ladysmith. Hi, Ruth.
Hi.
Oh, hi.
Quite a coincidence. This is great. I've been watching the Star Trek Next Generation videotapes in our library with a friend over the past year, and just this Tuesday we watched one that you, I don't know if you're aware of this, but it was episode about number 104, where Captain Picard is kidnapped, and he can't communicate with the person who kidnapped him, but their language is totally different from thousands of other species in the universe. Mm-hmm. However, they do speak a few English words for some reason, and he figures out that the language they're speaking is totally based on, I don't know if it's metaphors or similes or whatever, but analogies
Wow.
To things in their mythology, and you gotta listen. You gotta watch that one.
Oh,
it's just great.
Ruth, I'm not familiar with that, but I'm absolutely indebted to you for mentioning it.
It's,
you say episode 104?
It's episode 104, Ruth?
Approximately 104, 103, somewhere around there.
I'll track it down, believe me. I'll probably mention it. I have a weekly newsletter that I send out to about 10,000 subscribers all around the world. But once I track it down, I will mention it, and I will credit you with putting me on the hunt.
Thanks.
Thanks very much for the call. You may as well give your website in case people would like to do that.
Well,
Marty.
I have a website, www.drmarty.com, and the Dr. Marty is D-R-M-A-R-D-Y. It provides information about not only this book, but my other three word and language books. And can I just say one thing about them?
Yeah, sure.
Well, this was one of those pinch me, I'm dreaming moments that came to me last week. The book has been out for 2 weeks, and so I decided after a couple of days of publication I would go up to Amazon.com and see how the book was doing, because they rank all books. Actually, every hour they change the rankings. And they've got a category called quotation books in which you can discover which are the best-selling quotation books. And last week I went up, and the number 1, 2, 3, and 4 best-selling quotation books were all authored by me.
Aww.
Kathleen, I almost fainted. for many years I've had what I call a feel-good folder. And I started this back when I was in college. And in my feel-good folder, I put in these little things that have happened to me, or these little notes that occasionally people have sent me, the stuff that just warms my heart.
Right,
and my
good
soul.
Idea.
And
yes.
I keep it in there. So I immediately printed up that page of the Amazon.com website, and I put it in my feel-good folder.
That's a good idea. When you're feeling down.
You know, I've mentioned this in my seminars for the last 25 years, and I cannot tell you how many people who have never done that have started to do it, and 6 months later they've written me and said, thank you for that suggestion, because whenever I feel a little bit dejected or depressed or down in the dumps, mm-hmm. I just pull out that folder, and I'll tell you, it begins to chase the blues away.
Exactly. And then you can continue that by sending somebody else a note to put in their feel-good folder,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mark Twain once said, I can go for 2 months on one good compliment. And, you know, it's a lovely metaphorical thought, but it captures, you know, exactly what happens when somebody pays a tribute to us in a very full and,
yes.
and heartwarming way. I mean,
yes.
it just literally does, it figuratively does fill us up.
Yes, it does. Thank you, Ruth, so much. Let's go to Dan from La Crosse. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I have a master's degree in theology. My thesis was called Analogy and Paradox in Austin Fair.
Wow.
Austin Fair was not between Austin, Minnesota, and Austin, Texas. He was an Oxford professor. But as Appendix 1 to the thesis, I included a song I had written called Coming Closer to the Wind. And it's a sailing metaphor, but it talks about trying to go through life and reach God.
Wow.
So the wind is the Holy Spirit, and it happens to be a headwind, and Jesus is the captain, and you have to tack or zigzag, and you're heading for heaven's shore. I've written quite a few other songs and poems, so I just love the whole analogy metaphor thing.
Oh,
and
my
I
goodness, the whole notion of coming closer to the wind is a lovely expression. So you clearly are one of these masters of metaphor that Aristotle was talking about.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Dan, for your call. We go to Lynn from Fountain City. Hi, Lynn.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a degree in English and language arts and teaching, and I do like to read, but however, one of the trashier TV shows I do watch because of the excellent writing is Sex and the City. And as you know, Sarah Jessica Parker is an older woman, and she buys lots of shoes, and one of her lines is, I was literally an old woman who lived in her shoes. I just love that line, and I thought I was
Isn't that a nice line? You know, and Lynn, the fact that you're an English teacher, you know, makes me, I wish more English teachers would teach their students about analogies and metaphors and similes by using these lovely, rich, descriptive quotations that we're now talking about here today, because I recall back in my high school days, you know, they presented this stuff in such a boring way, it just turned people off.
Right.
Do you think English teachers are doing a better job at that these days?
Modern one would be like, if the shoe fits, buy the other one, I tell them, you know. So I'm wondering for you, because you mentioned television often, what are some of your favorite TV shows you watch, particularly because they have great similes or metaphors or great writing? One might be Seinfeld, or
Seinfeld has always been a classic. Yes, Seinfeld has always been a classic and a favorite of mine, but in my opinion, the most intelligently written television program of all time for me was Frasier.
I loved Frasier.
You know, I'm a psychologist, and so I of course appreciated it at that level as well. But you know, there was intelligent dialogue. This is not on the topic of metaphors, but I think you'll appreciate this, Lynn, because as an English teacher, you're familiar with vocabulary building exercises.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a wonderful word. It's called badinage. It is spelled B-A-D-I-N-A-G-E. And badinage refers to good-natured teasing between two people who actually like one another, but they're insulting one another. It's something that men do a lot. You know, we call it banter or busting each other's chops. And one night I'm watching an episode of Frasier, and that evening Niles had a party at his apartment. And when Frasier shows up and he knocks on the door, when Niles opens the door, Niles has got a parrot sitting on his shoulder. And Frasier looks over at Niles and he says, "Good evening, Niles. Or should I say, avast, you matey." And Niles looks back at Frasier and says, "Enough with the badinage, Frasier." And honest to goodness, I looked over at my wife, Catherine, and I said, "Honey, there's 24 million people watching this episode tonight, and me and two other guys know what he just said." But that's the value of these great, well-written television shows.
Yes.
Every now and then, they do elevate the level of dialogue.
Right. Thank you so much, Lynn, for the call. Let's go next to Tom from La Crosse. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I'm intrigued by mixed metaphors, and the best one I ever heard was on Wisconsin Public Radio, maybe even your show, Kathleen. A fellow was, what he meant to say was he offered someone an olive branch, but what he actually said was he handed him a fig leaf. And you guys, both you and your guests, kept a straight voice throughout the whole thing, but it just cracked me up.
I love that. When we mix a metaphor badly enough, Tom, it's called a mangled metaphor.
Mangled?
And the master of those was Samuel Goldwyn. And you know the expression, a lot of water has passed under the bridge?
Yes.
Well, one time he was talking about a situation where that metaphor was appropriate, but instead of saying those words, he said, "We've passed a lot of water since then."
we'll burn that bridge when we come to it, yeah. Oh, and do you have any southernisms or similes in your book? I suppose one of my favorites is I had a carpenter once who every time we put something in that was really tight, you know, just a nice tight fit, he'd say, "In there, like hair in a biscuit."
Oh, isn't that interesting? You know, nothing's coming to mind other than that famous line from Forrest Gump, "Life is like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get."
Mm-hmm.
But I have a feeling there might be one or two more of those in the book.
Okay, well, anyhow, love your show. Thanks.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks so much for your call.
Bye.
Our number is 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050. Let's get serious with him for a moment. I think some of these are really comforting, too. You have a chapter on the ages and stages of life. And I like this one. A dying man needs to die as a sleepy man needs to sleep. And there comes a time when it is wrong as well as useless to resist. I like that.
Well, there's, I mean, you know, I have chapters on so many different topics mm-hmm. here. We've got ages and stages of life and love and sex and politics and the literary life. And one of my favorite quotes from that ages and stages chapter is the one from Robert Louis Stevenson, who said, you know, old or young, we are all on our last cruise.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are sobering thoughts.
Right.
Another favorite one I have from Robert Louis Stevenson, and this is, again, I think probably in the Human Condition chapter, you know, he said, everyone sooner or later must sit down at a banquet of consequences. And, I mean, what, you know, he could have said, well, he could have used an old tired metaphor like, you know, well, the chickens come home to roost, you know, or he could say, you know, eventually you're going to pay for your sins, you know, but to refer to a banquet of consequences is just such a lovely way to refer to something that we all know happens in human life.
Right, yes. Let's go next to David from Port Wing. Hi, David.
Hello.
Hi.
I have two phrases that are useful to me occasionally. One is, the most expensive things in life are free.
Okay.
And my definition of education is never painless, almost always expensive.
Well, you know, this is very interesting, David, because the expressions that you are articulating there are what I call oxymoronic and paradoxical expressions. And I describe that in my book on oxymoronica. And those are fascinating as well. Do you want to go in that direction, Kathleen, too?
Yes, please. Go ahead.
Well, you know, when most people think about an oxymoron, they think about these clever little two-word constructions like old news or pretty ugly or military intelligence.
Right, right.
But really, when you look at an oxymoron, it's a compressed paradox. And in paradoxical observations, something is at one level false, but at another level true. And take the expression less is more. Now, less is more is literally false. Less is not more. But when Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, the German architect in the 1920s, said to a bunch of people that his most important design principle was less is more, he was articulating a paradoxical truth. And what he meant is that every time he almost finished a project, he would look at it one more time and take away 2 or 3% of the peripheral stuff around the edges of the idea, and it always improved it. And so I've got a whole book of these paradoxical and oxymoronic quotations, and the title of that book is called Oxymoronica, and some of them are absolutely profound. I'm a 13-year-old, a 13-year cancer survivor now, and of course I'm also a psychologist, and I've used a quotation 1,000 times in my life, but all of a sudden, 13 years ago, this quotation came back to help me, and it comes from Louis L'Amour, the great Western writer, and he said at the very beginning of a book called Lonely on the Mountain, he said, there will come a time when you will believe everything is finished. That will be the beginning. And, you know, when David talked earlier about the most expensive things in life are free, that's a perfect example of an oxymoronic passage. And I'll just mention one more because it comes from a person I admire so much, and it's Dolly Parton. And it proves that oxymoronic quotations can be witty as well as profound. She said, "You'd be amazed how much it costs to look this cheap."
I like that one.
It's cute.
That's good. And when you say, Marty, that that quote that you just read, there comes a time when everything is finished, that'll be the beginning,
yes,
has helped you. How does it help you? How do these things help you?
Well, you know, the way it helped me and the way it has helped some of the people that I've used it on is when people are in the middle of a crisis, what happens is there's a natural tendency to fear the worst.
Mm-hmm.
It's like in psychology, it's called catastrophic thinking. You know, so when somebody gets a divorce or they lose their job or, you know, one of their children is you know, sadly and tragically, you know, maybe killed or, you know, I mean, whenever a horrible thing happens in life, you know, what happens to people is it's the rug is pulled right out from under them. And they're automatically kind of thinking, oh, my God, you know, life is just not worth living again. And so for me, the meaning of that quote is when somebody has explored their despair with me, and I say to them, you know, a guy once wrote a passage that went this way, there will come a time when you will believe everything is finished. That will be the beginning. What happens is that you can almost see it on another person's face.
Hmm.
They start thinking, wow, somebody else has been in the same place
right.
that I've been in.
Yes.
And somebody else is now reflecting on that bad place from a future time.
Mm-hmm.
And there's even a little bit of a suggestion there that horrible event or that very difficult adversity that they're struggling with, a year later, it might even help to make them a somewhat better person.
Mm-hmm.
And so when people have a glimmer of hope in their eyes, that's why I've liked that quote. But I didn't realize that, you know, it would also kind of happen for me because,
right.
you know, when I was diagnosed with the cancer, I didn't know I didn't know if this was going to be a malignant cancer that was going to spread throughout my body.
Right.
As it turned out, I was very fortunate it did not. But, you know, I remember saying to my wife at the time, honey, if I survive this cancer, I'm never going to take any day of life for granted again.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't. I mean, you know, if I had been born in 1940 as opposed to 1942, I would be dead today because
right.
I'm just one of those very fortunate people that at age 50, you know, I got a PSA test, and it was able to diagnose very, very early a cancer
mm-hmm.
that just a couple of years earlier would not have been
Isn't
diagnosed.
Isn't that something? Right.
Yeah.
Oh, my. Thanks so much, David, for the call. Arise, I believe it is, from Spring Green. Hi.
Good morning.
Hello.
This is a really fascinating topic. I appreciate listening so much. Good things about it. The skyscraper was mentioned, and since I teach architecture, I would like to frame a question for your guest. The very contemporary, or let's say current metaphor, is the Beijing Olympic Stadium that's baptized as a bird's nest.
Yes.
And the analogy in architecture has been a tool for a long time, how architects conceive of shapes and then how they appeal to the public. One of those most persistent analogies has been the biological one, which goes way back to the early stages of the science of biology in the 1700s. But now we have a recurrence of this biological analogy with buildings that appear to have this direct relationship to natural objects or events. And what we try to grapple with in architecture is the notion of symbol. And my question now is, how does a metaphor relate to a symbol? In other words, is it something that comes after the metaphor, before? And can you shed some insight or some light into this subject?
Well, I'm not sure if I can shed a whole lot of light on the subject because, I would not consider myself an expert in symbolic logic or symbolic thinking. But architecture, I think, as you point out, you know, has been associated with wonderful language. And, you know, we do see it now with the Beijing Olympics, when we take a building and we relate it to something totally different. When people engage in what's called symbolic thinking, what they're doing is they're moving from the very literal realm to the figurative and symbolic realm. And I have a couple of architecture quotes in my definitive metaphors chapter that I think are spectacular. You're probably familiar with them, but I always thought that the best quote I ever heard on architecture was when the German philosopher Goethe said that architecture was frozen music. And I thought to myself, I mean, the first time I saw that, I was puzzled, and I said, what the heck does that mean? But, you know, once I thought about it, and this is what happens when you think metaphorically, is that if you could take music and you could freeze it and then shape it into a form, it might be appropriate to think of it as a kind of architecture. But then, all of a sudden, I came across another quote that I thought was even better. And it came from the artist Brancusi. He said, architecture is inhabited sculpture. And if you think about that, it's kind of fascinating, because these great architectural triumphs oftentimes look like sculpture, but they're unlike the kind of artistic sculpture we see in museums, because in these large sculptures, people can actually inhabit them. And so that's about the best I can do on the subject of architecture and symbols.
And not bad. A nice job it was.
Oh,
thanks, Aries, very much for your call. We're going to welcome more phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is the author of I Never Met a Four I Didn't Like, a comprehensive compilation of history's greatest analogies, metaphors, and similes. Dr. Marty Grothy is our guest, and we'll take more phone calls momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to more phone calls from Marty. Let's entertain Mike from Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Well, let me start by saying that I've been listening to this show for around 10, 20 years, and this has been the very finest show you've ever, ever, ever had. And I hope that you have this gentleman on again.
Mike.
What a compliment, Marty.
This must be my brother, Mike.
And I'm not
Mike, thank you so much. I mean, when Mark Twain said, I can go for 2 months and one good compliment,
there you go.
You know, you just proved the point.
You got it.
The meek shall inherit the earth, because they wind up with their faces in it.
Very nicely done.
Man looks into the abyss and sees nothing staring back at him. That's when he builds character, and that character is what stops him from falling into the abyss.
Is that Nietzsche?
I got it from a movie called Wall Street.
Oh, interesting. Huh. Yeah, that's based on a famous Nietzsche quote about staring into the abyss, and he ends that by saying, you must be careful when you stare into the abyss, because, you know, the abyss will sometimes begin to stare back into you.
It's beautiful. Thank you so much for the show.
Thanks, Mike, for your call.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
I do want to mention, having heard that wonderful compliment from Mike, you know, if any of your listeners are fascinated by this kind of stuff, I have a weekly newsletter. I call it Dr. Marty's Quotes of the Week. I send it out, you know, every weekend to about 10,000 subscribers. And, you know, all they've got to do is come up to my website, www.drmarty.com, and I'd be happy to sign them up. And every week they can be treated to some of the great quotations from some of the great wits and wordsmiths of all time.
Great. I'm sure you'll have some takers on that. Let's go to Tom from Verona. Hi, Tom. Hello. Oh, I didn't press the button right. Hi, Tom.
Am I on now?
You are. Hi.
I got a couple quick ones from sports teams in Detroit. There was a shortstop from back in the old days, and they signed a bonus, big bonus. They had to stay in the major league team, and they never got a chance to develop. So this guy named Reno Battoria from Windsor, Canada, and he never got to play very much. So finally they interviewed him and he said, you know, I think I'm in the twilight of a mediocre career. and then there was a Heisman Trophy winner they had for football, and he wasn't very coachable. So this old crusty middle linebacker coach sent him in, and out with plays. And finally, he said, if you want to send a messenger, call Western Union.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's a classic. That line goes back, to the 20s or 30s. But I have a whole chapter on sports metaphors. Tom, you might be interested. The title of that chapter is A Wonderful Metaphor from Howard Cosell, because nobody before him had ever related sports to department stores. Okay, but what he did is he said, sports is the toy department of human life.
Okay.
You know, isn't that a neat one?
Right.
Great, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one. Thanks very much for the call. Email, one of my favorite figures of speech was which was attributed to Groucho Marx on the television show Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip is, time flies like an arrow, fruit flies like a banana. Maybe I'm just slow, but it took me a couple of readings to get it. On the show, they had posted above a digital clock that counted down to airtime for their weekly show.
Isn't that funny?
Great.
Groucho Marx was spectacular.
Yes.
Thinking about sports metaphors, there are some really wonderful ones. But back in the 1960s, Duffy Doherty's team, Michigan State, went undefeated for the whole year, and so did Notre Dame. Hmm. And so they had a playoff game to see who was going to be ranked number one. And the game, and it was called the Game of the Century at the time, and the game ended in a 10-10 tie.
Hmm.
And at the end of the game, Duffy Doherty, this famous coach, said, a tie is like kissing your sister. Well, that was a good enough metaphor in its own right, but about 20 years later, this colorful Major League Baseball player named George Brett from the Kansas City Royals said, if a tie is like kissing your sister, losing is like kissing your grandmother with her teeth out.
Oh.
Again, see, these are visual images, and that's what happens when people engage in metaphorical thinking. It creates an image in our brains that is sometimes just unforgettable.
Yeah, it sure is. Let's go to Angie from Nina. Hi, Angie.
Hi. I had to take a class to renew my license, and so the class that I chose was summarization on any subject. And so we had to learn some or create some similes and analogies. The teacher gave us this little listing of some of, like, the worst analogies ever written in a high school essay.
Oh, perfect.
Because they had me laughing, I could not even see.
What were some of them?
His thoughts tumbled in his head, making and breaking alliances like underpants in a dryer without cling free.
That's brilliant.
A bride fell 12 stories, hitting the pavement like a hefty bag filled with vegetable soup.
Oh, no.
But the politician has gone on... But unnoticed, like the period after Doctor on the Dr. Pepper can.
Oh, my goodness.
And this one I think is kind of gross. Her hair glistened in the rain like Noah's hair after a sneeze.
Say that again.
Her hair glistened in the rain like Noah's hair after a sneeze.
Oh, boy.
And last one, her vocabulary was as bad as, like, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, wouldn't it be interesting, though, if while teaching metaphors and analogies and similes to high school students, the class could be instructed, to have a contest.
Right.
I mean, that would be a wonderful
yes,
way,
it would.
To relate these literary devices to the everyday lives of teenagers.
I came up with my own little simile for my one Manifest Destiny unit. I said they should think of Manifest Destiny like the playground bully. Both have people who believe they're entitled to something they don't own. The victims are people. Suffer physical violence and they lose their property.
Interesting. Yeah.
So that's a good one.
Like challenging
no, that's quite
like
lovely.
That. Mm-hmm. Well, that was it. Thank you. This
thanks,
was a fun,
Angie.
Fun
thank you,
show.
Angie.
Thank you. Thanks for your call. Betsy is next from Madison. Hi, Betsy.
I'd just like to share this expression with your audience that my friends and I enjoy. If you find yourself getting stiff in the joints, stay out of them.
If you find yourself getting stiff in the joints,
stay out of them.
Stay out. Perfect. Oh, that's very clever, Betsy.
I like it, too.
Thanks so much, Betsy, for your call.
You're welcome.
See, some of the best observations, you just got to think about it for a second.
Right,
that,
right.
As soon as you make the connection in your mind, it's like, yes.
Right. Yeah. Mary, probably our last call. We're running short on time. Maybe two more. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Hi.
My very favorite one. I don't have opportunity often enough to use, is That's like casting fake pearls before real swine.
Yes, yeah. See, that's what happens. You know, you take an old, age-old expression and you kind of just update it in a certain way.
Isn't that elegant, though?
Oh, it's perfect. Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Mary.
The other one that I like a lot, I think, is Groucho Marx. Outside of a dog, a book is a man's best friend. Inside of a dog, it's too dark to read.
Yeah, right. I've heard that one. That's great.
Written wordplay from Groucho Marx.
Thanks so much for this show. Yeah, thanks so much for the call, Mary. What are you working on next, Marty?
Well, I'm actually working on another book. Do you know what an aphorism is, Kathleen?
You know, I should, and I'd be.
Well, you know, everybody says that, and you should. Right. But an aphorism is spelled aphorism. An aphorism is a short, pithy quotation that communicates a lot of wisdom in very few words. A synonym for an aphorism would be a maxim. Mm. Anyway, I've been collecting aphorisms that all begin with the word if.
Okay.
Like Rita Mae Brown said, if the world were a logical place, men would ride side saddle. Okay, so I have a contract for a book that will come out next year, and the title of the book is going to be called Iforisms. all aphorisms that begin with the word if.
If, great. Marty, thank you so much for being with us. It was a great hour. I enjoyed it.
Thank you, Kathleen. I do appreciate your interest.
Our guest this hour, Dr. Marty Grothe, Grothe. The book is I Never Metaphor I Didn't Like, comprehensive compilation of history's greatest analogies, metaphors, and similes. It has just been published by Collins. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Tomorrow, Veronica Rickard is with you on Fridays, and I'll return on Monday with, well, big convention stuff going on, and also our All Things Political. Thanks for listening on the Ideas Network.